Hello and welcome to everyone who's watching or listening online and everyone gathered here today. I see some new faces or at least some new eyes among us, and it is good to have you here with us today. I don't know that I have any more to say beyond what those who have already said so well in response to the embarrassing, shameful, distressing, and unacceptable events we witnessed in our nation's capital last week. But I do have today for us some good news from the Gospel of John. And we may, by the time this is over, find out that this good news applies to our current situation. So let's begin reading in John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine. Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. And he did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Look, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Tony Campolo tells of a story he read in a newspaper years ago when a restaurateur who owned a restaurant located in a dry county in Georgia decided he wanted to serve wine to his guests. And so he filed a special petition with the county commissioners asking for an exception, which they promptly denied, even though the restaurateur made the argument that even Jesus drank wine. And one of the commissioners, who was also a deacon in the local Baptist church, responded by saying, "I know he did. And frankly, I've always been embarrassed by him because of it." I know many of you well enough to know that, like me, you are not embarrassed by Jesus drinking wine. More than that, you like it that Jesus not only drank wine, but he made some, and you love it that the wine Jesus made was not only good with three goods, it was also abundant. There was a lot of it. But we all can admit, this is a weird way for Jesus to launch his public ministry in the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus launches his ministry by drawing a crowd with the power of his preaching and the power of his healing. And then once that crowd is there, he delivers to them what we know as the Sermon on the Mount. In the Gospel of Mark, he launches his ministry by driving an evil spirit out of a man in a synagogue. In the Gospel of Luke, he preaches a controversial sermon in his hometown synagogue. It went over so well that those who had watched him grow up, had known him from the time he was a little boy, wanted to throw him off a cliff. But in the Gospel of John, Jesus launches his public ministry by performing a quiet, reluctant miracle. One he seems to only do because his mother asked him to. Back then, Jewish weddings could last up to 7 days. They were festive occasions for the whole village or the whole neighborhood. It was an opportunity for those who were carrying the burdens of living under the Roman Empire to kick up their heels a bit and celebrate. And at some point during the festivities, Jesus' mother becomes privy to some embarrassing information. The party has run out of wine. And this was a major social faux pas. It would bring shame and disgrace upon the bridegroom and his family. You do not run out of wine before the party's over. And who knows why the host didn't make adequate provisions. Maybe there was a global pandemic and everyone had doubled their wine consumption. Maybe Jesus' disciples, who were likely late additions to the guest list, maybe they showed up and drank more than their fair share. Truth is, we don't know, and those details are more important to us than they are to John. But what he does want us to know is that Jesus' mother sees a problem, and she believes that Jesus is the one who can do something about it. And his response to his mother is perhaps a bit more terse than we would like it to be. Woman, why are you bothering me with this? How is this any of our business? Now, in this context, woman is not a term of disrespect, but it does convey some distance. Mary, who gave birth to Jesus, who raised Jesus, the Word made flesh, God in the flesh, Mary must now become a disciple of her son. He goes on to explain his reluctance. He says, "My hour has not yet come." In the Gospel of John, Jesus' hour almost always refers to the culminating events of his mission on earth. His hour includes his arrest, his trial, his crucifixion, his burial, his resurrection, even his ascension when he goes back to the Father. All of that is what Jesus means when he says, it's not time yet. It's not my hour. Because he knows once he goes public, if he does this thing that his mother seems to want him to do, there will be no turning back. His mother is unwittingly asking him to take his first step toward the cross. So interestingly enough, she only shows up one more time in the Gospel of John. And that's at the end of the story when he's dying on a cross. And he calls her woman there as well. She's there at the beginning, and she's there at the end. And she doesn't argue with her son. She also doesn't take no for an answer. Instead, she goes to the servants and she says, "Do whatever he tells you." And then she leaves it up to Jesus to do whatever he wants to do. And that's a lesson in discipleship right there. Present the problem to Jesus. Be ready to do whatever he wants you to do, he tells you to do. And then wait for his wise, loving, always appropriate response. And be prepared to celebrate when his response blows your expectations out of the water. Now that's a little sermon right there. Speaking of water, what Jesus says to do is he tells the servants, fill those big water jars, stone water jars over there. They were used for purification rites. Fill those to the brim with water. And they do, and then he says, now take some of that water to the master of the banquet. And they do, and it's no longer water. It's wine. And this is why some describe this as a quiet or hidden miracle. There's no indication that Jesus stands up and does anything dramatic. There was no thunder or lightning. He didn't say a prayer, didn't clap his hands, didn't snap his fingers. One moment, those jars are filled to the brim with water. And then in the next moment, they are filled with up to 180 gallons of wine, which is the modern equivalent of 900 bottles of wine. There is plenty of wine now. As a side note, sometimes on Thursday afternoons, I go down to Royal Blue Grocery at Highland Park Village. It's a combination coffee shop and grocery store. I go down there, get a cup of coffee, find a place to sit, and I work on my sermon. And I did that this past Thursday, bought a cup of coffee and found the only seat at the only table available in the whole shop. And I started working on the sermon. And I got to this point where I was trying to figure out how many bottles of wine are there in 180 gallons of wine. Google is always your friend when you have that kind of question. And I'm trying to figure it out. When for the first time I look up and really notice where I'm sitting in this grocery store slash coffee shop, the only chair at the only table available for me to work on this sermon about Jesus turning water to wine was next to their giant wine section. I know a sign from the Lord when I see one. And to those of you who are wondering, no, I did not have a glass as I finished this sermon. I would never drink wine that expensive while working on a sermon this cheap. But there it was. Tons of wine, lots of wine. There was a lot of wine at that wedding now after Jesus did his thing. But there was not only an abundance of it, it was also excellent. The best. So much so that the master of the banquet thinks there's been a huge mistake. And he says to his friend, the bridegroom, look, you're supposed to serve this first when you want to impress your guests with the quality of the wine. You splurge at the beginning when their senses are still sharp and can appreciate the quality. Not now. He says, you've saved the best for last. And that is the extent of Jesus' first miracle. There's no indication that anyone other than his mother, the servants, and his disciples even knew what he had done. But it was enough for his disciples to see his glory, which Jesus told them they would see when he first recruited them. Said at the end of chapter 1, you will see heaven open up and angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. You're going to see glory. But they never expected the glory to look like unlimited wine. They believe in him. They put their trust in him. It bolsters their faith in Jesus. After all, they've only been following him for a few days. And actually, John never calls this a miracle. Never uses the word. What he calls it is a sign. And that is an important distinction. What do signs do? Signs point to something else. There's a lot of pointing in the Gospel of John. John the Baptist points to Jesus. Jesus' disciples point to Jesus. This sign Jesus does points to something else. Signs point to something else. For example, here's a sign from West Texas. When you only have one tree, you tend to make a big deal out of it. Now, if on a hot day, you're looking for some shade and you see this sign, are you going to go sit under this sign? No, you're going to let this sign point you to the place where you can find some shade. That's what signs do. That's what signs are for. That's how the signs, and there are a number of them in the Gospel of John, that's how they function in this gospel. They point to something else. This sign, this amazing thing that Jesus does at this wedding, the point of it is not the sign in and of itself, the amazing thing. Well, this amazing thing, this sign is pointing beyond itself, pointing to something bigger, pointing to something deeper, pointing to something more important. The point of this sign at this wedding, turning water to wine, is not that Jesus' disciples will never run out of wine. It's that Jesus is the one that God's people have been waiting for. More than that, he's better than anything or anyone else that has come previously in the story of God. better than Moses, better than David, better than any of the prophets, better than John the Baptist. In Christ, God truly has saved his best for last. In Christ, God has initiated that long-awaited time of forgiveness and restoration and blessing, a time the prophets describe in terms of, you guessed it, an abundance of fine wine. Here's what Amos says in chapter 9. He said, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills, and I will bring my people back from exile." This is a sign of the new thing that God is doing. He goes on to say, "They will rebuild their ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit." And then Isaiah says this in chapter 25, "On this mountain the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth." That's the sign of wine. And the sign also illustrates what John said about Jesus back in the prologue when he's introducing the gospel. It says, "The Word became flesh," in verse 14, "lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth." And then he says in verse 16, "From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace, abundant, overflowing grace." That's what comes into the world in Christ. So what does God's grace taste like? John says it tastes like the very best of wine, overflowing, never running out. You never, ever have to worry about a shortage of God's grace. There will always be plenty for everyone. There's also a hint of resurrection in this sign. John tells us in verse 1, chapter 2, that this happens on the third day. Third day. A little bit later in chapter 2, just a few verses down, Jesus is no longer in Cana in Galilee. He's gone to Jerusalem, and he's overturning the tables at the temple and condemning it for being more of a marketplace than a meeting place with God. And when the religious leaders and authorities question him, this is what he says to them in John chapter 2, verse 19. Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." And the temple he had spoken of was his body. Third day, 3 days. This happened on the third day. Jesus says something else is going to happen in 3 days, after 3 days. Third day, 3 days. If this bracketing of third day, 3 days in chapter 2 is intentional, and with John there always seems to be some deeper meaning swimming below the surface. If it's intentional, then John is giving us a nod, maybe a wink, perhaps a nudge, saying, hey, this story about Jesus turning water to wine, this is a resurrection story. This sign is pointing into the future. Jesus is giving new life to a dead party. The Father will give new life to Jesus' dead body. And someday, Christ will save his best for last and raise us from the dead and give us new life. This is a resurrection story. And so maybe this is not such a weird way for Jesus to launch his public ministry. It's entirely appropriate because what Christ does for this dead party is what he will someday do for all of creation. But this sign is not only pointing into the future. It's also pointing to what Christ can do in our lives and in our world right now. Right now, life doesn't feel like much of a party, does it? And it's not because we've run out of wine. Go down to Royal Blue. They have plenty of wine, maybe too much wine. Life doesn't feel like much of a party right now, but it's not because we've run out of wine. It's because our party has run out of love. Love for our neighbors, love for our enemies. It's because our party has run out of civility. It's run out of decency. It's run out of peace making. It's run out of truth. It's run out of wisdom. And it's embarrassing, and it's shameful, and even dangerous. So what do you do when your party runs out of life? You invite the source of life to your party. What do you do when your marriage runs out of love? You invite the one whose sacrificial actions define love. What do you do when your relationships and your interactions run out of grace? You invite the one through whom God's grace overflows into your heart. What do you do when your society runs out of wisdom? You invite the one who is God's wisdom personified in the flesh into everything you as a follower of Christ do. You present the problem to Jesus, and then you be prepared to do whatever he tells you to do, trusting that God's best for you, God's best for those you love, God's best for those you do not love, God's best for all of creation is still yet to come. May we all drink deeply of the wine of God's grace, love, and truth. And may it overflow from our hearts into the world around us, until all of creation is dripping with the joy of the Lord.